Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, fellow liberals and Democrats, inquisitive Republicans, and concerned citizens of all backgrounds. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. Welcome aboard, and let's get to work.
I'm out of town at a conference this week, so instead of the usual show...
This show is a replay of the show on genocide that I first aired
last
April. It's a very special show that received high marks from international genocide prevention organizations like Genocide Watch. There'll be no Hall of Fame and Shame after this show. Next week, we also have a special show, an interview with one of the heads of the FBI's efforts against Al-Qaeda. Our regular programming will return on November 24th and 25th. So we'll get started right after this.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes. Florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business, makes you sensational.
The show you are about to hear aired originally in April of 2013. The audio has been remastered, and if you heard the show before, you should notice quite an improvement. I think people are going to be surprised at how much commonality there is in the experiences of genocide survivors, both in terms of what they went through and also, unfortunately, the difficulties each community experienced afterwards in many things, including getting justice. Joining us to talk about genocide are Karine Shnohorkian. She's the grandchild of survivors of the Armenian genocide. We also have Saul Rosenkrantz. Saul was born in Poland and is a survivor and of and frequent speaker on the Holocaust. Bunyam is a survivor of and author of a book about the killing fields in Cambodia. And Dida Nibagwiri, a survivor of the Rwandan genocide, joined us from Kigali, Rwanda. I'm very grateful to each of our participants. I know that for survivors, telling the story and reliving those experiences is not easy. And that includes descendants of survivors, as I well know, since I myself am the child of a Holocaust survivor. That being said, we're going to go in chronological order in terms of which genocides happened first. From April 24, 1915 until 1923, the Ottoman Empire went about the destruction of its minority Armenian population. By 1923, up to 1.5 million Armenians perished, and there were virtually no ethnically Armenian people living in what had then become the Republic of Turkey. As the Armenian genocide was 100 years ago, any survivors who would remember anything would have to be over 105, and so there aren't many left now. But the story has been passed down to their children and their children's children. Karine Shnohorkian is the grandchild of survivors, and here is her story.
Yes, and I just want to thank you, Stephen, for organizing such an important and emotional topic, especially for many of the survivors that are on today.
Yeah.
As you had mentioned, I am of Armenian descent. I come from a family of survivors, both on my parents' side, my mom and my father, as well as my husband, who has survivors within his own family. And, you know, even though I didn't survive, I wasn't a survivor myself, you know, it lives within families. And as the current people on this call will tell you, you know, as they have children or continue to move forward, surviving and telling the story is quite important. It also lives within me personally because for many Armenians, the struggle we face today is not only remembering and reliving the stories, but the ongoing denial that the Turkish government continues to push forward in, you know, denying that such a horrific event ever happened. Before I get into my story, I just want to mention for those that may not be aware, the Armenian Genocide occurred from 1915 to 1923 by the hands of the Ottoman Turkish government, claiming the lives of 1.5 million Armenians, which is roughly 75% of the population at that time. My stories and reflections today will come from my father's father and the stories that had existed that he witnessed as a young child, about 4 or 5 years old at the time, which haunted him until he passed away. The unfortunate reality of genocide is that your innocence as a child is taken away, and he had to live with this for 70 years until, you know, he passed away in the 1980s, and he grew up very quickly after witnessing the tragedies of seeing 28 of his family members die in front of him during the time of the genocide. And, you know, as a young child myself, I never really understood what was happening. It wasn't something in an Armenian household that you normally would discuss. It's not a dinner table conversation. It was, you know, terrible things happened, shush, eat your dinner, and let's move on. And, you know, being young, I was, you know, a third grader at the time when my grandfather had suffered a stroke. He was bedridden. And, you know, we were always forced to go into the room and give him a kiss and say hello. And, you know, the smells and the hospital bed and the medicines was very intimidating for me as a child. But the one thing that was always frightening is, you know, as we were having dinner, screams that would come from his room. And I thought, you know, he was just in pain at the time, but later would learn that those screams was something that he lived with his entire life due to the traumatic memories of seeing his family members perish in 1915.
The denial that Armenians continue to face even today, 100 years later, is a festering wound in that community that forces them to continually remember what has happened to them. Let's hear what life was like for Karine's grandfather in the run-up to the genocide.
Moving into my family's story, which is, you know, what I want to talk about right now, is my father's family, they're from a province called Marash, and it's from present-day Turkey today, about 200 miles north from Aleppo, Syria, which is the easiest to describe. They were farmers. They did well. They had a lot of influence within Marash, and even today, when we've had family go back there, they know the family. My maiden name is Boyrazian, and they know the Boyrazu family, and they know the province. They know the areas where we had our farmlands. We did quite well in the region, and that did work to our advantage in terms of having my grandfather and some other family members survive. Not everybody, but to the extent of what we were able to do. And within the area where they live in a large courtyard, which is a very common thing in these villages in Turkey at the time, where there were large courtyards that families lived within. There was like a large fountain, separate doors for the cattle stock, for livestock, and separate doors for people to enter, and a large barnyard where, you know, a lot of animals and livestock would live. And we had a Turkish, my grandfather's father lived next to a Turkish gentleman. His name was Nuri. And so many times during genocide, you do hear stories of the perpetrator's side. In this case, you know, the Turkish side helping the victims. And this gentleman, Nuri, knowing that, you know, helping an Armenian or helping the person that they were trying to victimize was, in fact, death. It was, you were seen, you know, it happened, you know, you saw it during the Holocaust, you see it during other genocides, that if you help them, you will be subjected to death. And knowing that, though, he still...
Karine describes a family just like any other, but with a grandfather who sometimes screams at the night, tormented by unknown tormentors, or at least that is what Karine thought when she was young. At some point, she was told the story of what produced those screams. Let's listen.
Knowing that, though, he still would help. And he had warned my great-grandfather that things were happening, bad things were going to happen, that he had heard accounts of other villages. And this was, you know, 1915, the summer months, and to be careful. And they took precaution. You know, the little ones, the little kids at the time, they weren't allowed to just run amok. You know, they had very close eyes on everybody. And in one circumstance, Nudi had run up to my great-grandfather and said, "We've gotten word that Turkish armed guards are on their way to this area, and they're looking for Armenians. Go and protect yourself." So there wasn't enough time to protect everybody, but my great-grandfather took his two little boys, his wife, and another family member. And, you know, within a lot of these courtyards, the homes had cellars that you would go and you would store your food storage, because back then, you know, that was the way you would keep things cold in the summer and protect it from, you know, spoiling. So they ran down to that cellar, and there was a large carpet that you put over, and they were able to hide. And it was a cellar, so you couldn't really hear what was going on, but my grandfather had remembered, you know, waiting what seemed like days for a five-year-old in order to try and get out. And later on in the evening, several hours had passed. They hadn't heard anything. They hadn't heard any noises. So, you know, they came out from the cellar, where my grandfather, who was a mischievous little boy, you know, kind of ran out right away to see what was going on. And it was dark at that point. And they were looking for their family members, and they couldn't find anybody. Everything was empty. The houses were, you know, upside down in terms of things that were stolen and just destruction. And you could hear noises coming from the barn that the livestock were in, and you could hear this moaning coming. And it didn't sound like an animal, but, you know, he wasn't quite sure what was going on. And when he went in, which was, you know, the biggest mistake for a five-year-old, is when he witnessed 28 of his family members lying on the floor, brutally massacred, cut, their heads, you know, had been slit, naked. The woman, you know, had been, you know, raped, and he ran to the moaning that he had seen, and it was one of his favorite aunts who hadn't quite died yet and was moaning, and they had slit her throat, but not enough to the point where she was dying, and that was the last thing that he had seen and that he had taken away from that moment, seeing his aunt that he loved so much being, you know, dying, and there was nothing you could do.
This is an almost unimaginable scene. A young boy cooped up in a cellar for a number of hours. If you've known any five-year-old boys, you can imagine that the moment after they get the chance to run out and play, that's exactly what they're going to do. Of course, what this poor child, Karine's grandfather, then sees is a scene that will produce nightmares for him for the rest of his life. Let's hear the rest of Karine's story.
The only thing you can do now is survival. They needed to get out. They needed to find a way to leave. And thankfully, their Turkish friend Nudi helped. They got two donkeys with side cart baskets, where my grandfather and his brother rode on the side carts, which was very common. My husband's grandmother, she told me the same story, where she remembers riding on the side cart of a donkey as well on her trip. And they had went down to Aleppo, to Syria, where they had stayed and resided. They were able to safely get out due to them having money and knowing people. And, you know, again, not every Turkish person wanted the Armenians killed. You know, this was coming from orders from the Ottoman Empire, the government at that time. You know, the story continues in which, even in 1921, they had been living in Syria as refugees for quite some time, and they had heard that, you know, the genocide was over, there was a new, you know, a government, and it was safe to go back. And they had gone back to Marash because that's where their lives were. They had all of their investments there, their livestock. And they did go back and try and survive for about, 6 to 8 months. But later on, additional massacres happened. And at that point, they just left everything and went to Lebanon.
That's actually a fairly common experience, right, Karine? At that point, this is when you have this massive Armenian diaspora happens. That's where you have, as a result, all of these communities of Armenians all over the world as a result of what happened at that point. And, until today, still, Turkey doesn't recognize what happened to Armenians there as a genocide. Now, before I move on, I want to mention that while some of the Armenian genocide was going on, Turkey was on the side of the Central Powers in the First World War, alongside Germany and Austria-Hungary. And there were a lot of German engineers working in the Ottoman Empire to build railway systems and other projects, and they witnessed the atrocities against the Armenian people. And they sent communiques back to Germany about what was going on. And I wonder to what extent those communiques of death marches and people were actually gassed in Armenia. That was the first time that poison gas was used in mass killings. I'm wondering how much of that set a blueprint for what happened later in Germany. And one other point I want to make before I move on to Mr. Saul Rosenkrantz is that in August 22, 1939, a week before the invasion of Poland, Hitler wrote about the decision to invade Poland in a document that was handed to an American journalist in Germany by the name of Louis Lochner. In it, Hitler wrote, "I have issued the command, and I'll have anyone who utters but one word of criticism executed by firing squad, that our war aim does not consist in reaching certain lines, but in the physical destruction of the enemy. Accordingly, I have placed my death head formations in readiness for the present only in the east, with orders to them to send to death mercilessly and without compassion men, women, and children of Polish derivation and language. Only thus shall we gain the living space or Lebensraum which we need. Who, after all, speaks today of the annihilation of the Armenians?" Now, this brings up a central theme that I want everyone who hears this show to think about. What lessons are we sending to potential future perpetrators of genocide when we allow the vast majority of the criminals who participate in any genocide to go unpunished? Or when we refuse to recognize a genocide as such? In this case, we know the lesson that Hitler seemed to take from what happened to the Armenians. I wonder in the cases of the Holocaust and of Cambodia and Rwanda, what the result would have been of a quick and vigorous prosecution of the majority of the perpetrators of previous genocides. While we're all pondering that question, I want to turn things over to Saul Rosenkrantz, who was born in Grabow, Poland, to hear about his Holocaust experience. Saul?
Well, I would like to talk about the city that I come from, my family, and myself, the experience on the Holocaust. Well, as you all know, the war started on September 1, 1939, a Friday, and within 10 days, the Germans came into my city, which is located in central Poland. Within 10 days, they came in, and right away, they started punishing Jewish people. And if I may to describe the punishments, and the decrees that they came out with. First thing they did is deny the Jewish people walking in on the sidewalks. We had to walk in the gutter. Next, they issued a decree that everyone will have to put on a yellow Star of David in the front and the back. Next, they issued a decree that any Jewish man wearing a beard must cut his beard immediately. And of course, they didn't give us any time at all right away to start cutting. Hunting people with beards, and they do their own cutting, and they massacre so many people, impossible to describe. Next, they took the rabbi, and of course they made sure Jewish men come and watch that scene. They took the rabbi and his entire family, the rabbi, his wife, and they had three sons, and they placed them against the synagogue wall on the outside, and they massacred, shot, gunned down the entire family, because it's about 70 years after the war, and I still have nightmares from that scene.
So right away after they invade, the Nazis embark on their policy of the final solution for Poland's Jews. something also going on in Germany itself and will soon be going on in much of mainland Europe. Saul talks of how the Nazis set up ghettos in many cities in conquered countries, including his. The ghettos are a section of the city where Jews are forced to live. This is the first step in the genocide. When all the Jews are in one place, the Nazis can subject them to any mistreatment and ultimately deport them to concentration camps and death camps. The Nazis have no compassion for old, for sick, or for the young. Saul is a boy in his teens and becomes aware of a special so-called job the Nazis have for boys in the ghetto. Let's listen.
So as soon as the ghetto is established, the German police are telling the Jewish police that they must send up young people to maintain the building, because it was a small, very small primitive city, no running water, we had to maintain the building. So the Jewish police is sending up young boys to maintain the building, boys and girls. But the main job for the boys was to go into their bedrooms where they were sleeping and take out their boots for shining, and they had to be shined just like a mirror. But this was a little bit an impossible situation, because it was a big building, no carpeting, not an inch of carpeting anywhere in the building. The floors were bone dry and they were squeaking. And here these guys came back from night duty about an hour and a half ago, and the floors are squeaking and waking them up. As a result, they jumped off their beds and they grabbed these kids and they beat them up so badly. Not for the punishment, but just to see the blood. They had to see blood gushing from their nose every day, every morning.
So the cruelty here is unimaginable. Each day, the Jews in the ghetto have to send their young boys to shine the shoes of these Nazi guards, and the situation is set up so the young Jewish children can't help but wake up the guards, and thus a vicious beating ensues. Soon the Nazis deport all of the adults, except for the young and old, to concentration camps and death camps. As bad as that is, Saul then hears of a new danger.
By this time, by 42, there is only old and young people are remaining in every ghetto. And also by this time, they devised the system to kill people en masse systems on their way to mass graves. So this family escaped from this scenario, from a nearby city, a neighboring city from us, to the west, 15 kilometers. But after his city, another 20 kilometers, is a mass grave sepulchre. So he escaped and he managed to come in here. And he also tells me that he did not come in to stay, because he knew, we didn't know it at that time, but he knew that our city is going to be next. Not only next, but very, very shortly, within days. And they had a plan to escape further to the south from us. Why? Because the Germans put up two model cities for the world. Should the Red Cross come, they would see that the Germans are treating the population, especially Jews, well, which was only a model city, two model cities. So Mr. Greenfeld knew that somehow, and he also had a Jewish smuggler by the name Steinberg that is going to come in a day or two and trying to get him out from our ghetto to bring him to that new place across the border. As soon as I heard that scenario, of course my family knew it. They listened into the entire case. I was, something popped into my head, and I came up with a plan that I will plan an escape.
Now, escape from the ghetto, as dangerous as that is, becomes imperative. Saul and his family split up according to Saul's plan and are able to escape. But towards the end of his escape, Saul encounters a problem.
But the end of the city, all of a sudden, it's a city that comes to an abrupt stop. There is no small city before. All of a sudden, it's naked field after that city, and the trolley came into the last stop. So there must have been a bunch, 15, 20 smugglers that are waiting at the last stop to guide some people to get some money, to make some money from it, which I did. I took one of the guys, gave him a bundle of money, and he points with his finger into the field, into the bare field. There was a lone little hut standing there, and he says, make sure you go into the little hut. The peasant woman knows what to do. So we finally, after a big struggle, the snow was knee-deep, we got in. And the woman sends everybody up to the attic. This is the border. We are on the border. The woman sends everybody up on the attic. And I decided not to go up. For whatever reason, I'll never know. I decided not to go up. She takes me inside. And she asked me to sit down, gave me a cup of coffee. And, of course, she knows that we're Jewish people, and she's a smuggler. She knows that. And if I was to tell you, about an hour later, a German border guard with a German shepherd comes in from my right and sits himself down just opposite me at the table. And he noticed that I'm wearing a watch, and he tries to buy that watch from me. He wanted to buy that watch. And in German, I pretend that I don't understand a word of German, and I answer him everything in Polish. Not to the point. He was talking about a watch in German. I'm talking about something else in Polish. Not to the point. Because I knew, usually I knew that the German border guards, generally speaking, are trained people. They're smart. They know how to investigate. So I didn't want to answer him because if he would be smart enough to come to surmise that the Jewish language and the German language are quite similar. And if I know German, I also might be Jewish. And this is what I try to avoid. Well, sure enough, he back and forth, questions and answers, and I did not give him the right time, and he just picked himself up and went.
After enduring all of what he endured in the ghetto with his family, and after meticulously planning and making good their escape from the ghetto, Saul gets horrible news.
From here, until now, I was in the ghetto. From this point on, I'm starting a ghetto, six ghettos. Two in Poland, two in Germany, two more in Czechoslovakia. So let me just, one important point. The first tent that I came into, I was given a job near the periphery of a factory. And what do I see outside that fence? 25 feet from the fence, the main tracks leading up towards Warsaw, towards Treblinka. Treblinka was nothing but a killing place, a factory killing people. And what do we see starting in August? Trains rolling by on those tracks, loaded with Jewish people, 40, 50 cars to a train, and of course, sealed cars, and they throw out notes from the little windows, and those notes fall down on the ground. We cannot go and get them. Polish people living on the outside, the kids are running back and forth to pick up the notes. They push it into our camp, and we are the first recipients of those notes. Now, this is starting in August. And again, of course, in August, we still go home to the ghetto, to that city. Walking distance. Now, again, moving into September, I get a note from my family, whom I saved in March, and they were on one of those trains on their way to Treblinka.
Saul's family are part of the 800,000 Jews who were murdered at the Treblinka death camp alone. Saul survived six concentration camps, two in Poland, two in Germany, and two more in Czechoslovakia, where he was eventually liberated by the Russians. Of the first three genocides we're going to talk about today, the Holocaust has probably had the most perpetrators brought to justice, but that isn't saying much. Yes, the Nuremberg trials involved some of the top leadership, but the vast majority of the Nazis who took part in the Holocaust escaped justice, and many others received light sentences. Now, moving on to the Cambodian genocide, which took place from April 1975 until January 1979, during the time the Khmer Rouge were in control of Cambodia. I spoke with Boon Yam, who wrote a book about his experiences called Tomorrow I'm Dead. Let's listen.
Hello, Steve. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
It's my name is Bunyam, B-U-N-Y-O-M. I'm born in Cambodia. Tell about my story, how to survive, and tell another how to survive too. But 1975, after the Cambodian New Year, that day we have my family freedom. Everybody have fun, walk together, and help together. And that 1975, when United Army take troops home, and then Khmer Rouge, they take over the Cambodia, the whole city. And what he do did, he do that, he take all the Cambodians, get out of the house. They announcement, they say, don't take anything out from the house, just go buy one piece of clothes, and we come back another 2 days later. And they yell to the people, say, hurry up, because the Vietnam, they bomb in Cambodia right now. That day, my father, my mother, they come from a big city, and then they come find me, and in the, I'm working a farmer for my uncle. That's my uncle, that day, he know the Khmer Rouge come in, because he looked like mayor of the city, and then he know what's going on, and then he take his family, include my young brother. And he tell me, he say, Boon, you stay here. I take my family, go to Thailand first, before I come back, I come get your family too. That day when I wake, my uncle take off, and then I wake like half hour, I saw my mom, my dad walk, come find me from big city. My father say, something wrong. That day, I'm only 14 years old in a farmer. I'm still at school. When I'm 14, I got one year college already, so I got to go to second year college after Cambodian New Year. But the Khmer Rouge take over, and fourth of all people go to in the jungle, empty in city, like everybody get out.
So the order comes from the Khmer Rouge, leave your cities, leave your towns and villages, and head into the jungle. Khmer Rouge troops are waiting in each of the cities and towns, forcing people to leave their homes at gunpoint. Boon tells of what the evacuation of cities and towns was like.
From that day, like 2 days, 3 days later, we had no food. And then the Khmer Rouge announcement said, well, we need some kids, all kids, like go get food, because we have in the jungle, like 3 days out, we had no food. My young brother, he just only 6 months old, that young brother. And he cried, we ran out of milk. He don't drink water, have no food, have no nothing for 3 days. And my mom say, tell my brother, tell me and my sister, we all enough, go get food. Because the Khmer Rouge, the older, need some kids, go get some food, because we have no food for 3 days. And my three brother sister walk away from my brother, my young brother with my mom and dad, and they stay one place, and then we get out. That day, I saw my mom, my brother, my father, the last day, his face. And my sister and my old brother, we walk together, Khmer Rouge already take out there. And a day later, Khmer Rouge say, well, the girl go to the girl side, the boy go to the boy side. And that day, I saw my sister walk to the girl side. I tell them, if you find, you go get food first, bring to mom and dad and young brother, okay? And then if I find food first, I bring to them too. So that day, I don't see my sister's face separate right there.
And at that point, the family was separated.
Yeah, they start separated.
Boon then tells of a selection process that the Khmer Rouge put people through once they were all in the jungle. Let's listen.
After they sit down right there, and then they ask one by one, long line, and all black hair, sit on the field. They ask kids one by one. They say, "Are you kid mother, father be a lawyer or teacher or rich people?" Some kids say, "Yeah, my mom business lady," and they take kid away, put another different side. And they ask another kid, they say the farmer, they put different side. So we figure out all that kids answer. They have education like a mom and dad, teacher, lawyers, doctor, something like that. They take them, go to different place, and then they kill them.
Boon and many of the other kids learn that the correct answer is to say that you are completely ethnically Cambodian and that you are the children of farmers. This is harder to do for adults. Children may not yet know how to farm, but if an adult says they're a farmer, but then know nothing about farming, the Khmer Rouge pick that up pretty quickly and send that person to their deaths. Boone convinces the Khmer Rouge guarding his group that he is a child of farmers, despite the fact that his parents had owned several businesses. After the initial selections and killings, the Khmer Rouge force the people into the Khmer Rouge's version of a utopian collective agrarian society.
Oh, yeah, that's after they take a test, all the kids, a thousand in the field, all done, and they tell us long line, and they say, okay, take all your clothes out. So they take all the color clothes out, jewelry, diamond, gold, necklace. Some kids have glass, and then they take them out. They cannot see, they put it back, and say, okay, you keep your glass. And another group, they give us one piece of clothes, all white. And then the Khmer Rouge say, well, we are all the same, no rich, no poor, no nothing. We all the same. One color, and then we eat the same thing. After we do give us our clothes one pair, and then they point to another side, they say, that's your equipment. Go to work. I say, well, we go to work. They tell us go get food for our parents for, we have no food for 3 days, and then why we let us go to work? After they give me equipment, go to work, and then Khmer would say, you know what, you go to work for food. And I don't say nothing in my mind. I say, wow, how do you do that? And after that, another night, we have no food for 5 nights already. We have no food at all. We just drink water in the jungle. No sea city, no sea house, no sea nothing. And after we go to close to the work, they say, you see that right there? I say, anybody saw that? Yeah, that's a dam. So dig the dirt from here, bury water over there. Try to make the dam across the river. Another side over there. I said, wow. And that day we start dig the dirt from here, dump right there. Every hour, every month, and they feed us. They feed us only one soup, the soup rice, and a salt, that's all. 24 hours around the clock. We work 23 hours, and we take 1 hour, take a break.
This is life for Boon Yam and the rest of the population of Cambodia for 3 years. One small ration of watery rice per day, 20-plus hours of work per day, 7 days a week, and one pair of clothing. Boon talks about hunger killing thousands around him and sleeping among dead bodies. He also talks about how people would eat anything edible on which they could get their hands. Finally, in 1979, Boon gets a break.
Yeah, the first time when the Cambodia take me out from a terminal, we go to the Cambodia Freedom Camp. First time I go down there, that's all I have. Head, no hair and a skin and bone and no meat, no nothing. And here, like 4 months later, we got more energy. We got my hair grow back. I got my meat back. And then the Cambodia Freedom training us. I'm here getting out with the Khmer Rouge. We see my crews. That's the job. And like 6 months later, I got more power. And then after my boss, I want to go to Cambodia to help people. The first step, my mom let me go. I go inside a city. I bring like 1,000 people the first time, have no gun, no protection, or nothing. And then get out from the city, driving that people. So the first step, it's scared to get people out from a scenario. And then after that, go one more trip, I go to a different city, I take all the people out, I don't let one live inside the city, because they need the Khmer to kill. Kill them all.
Wow.
Every time I go down to Cambodia, I find people like at least 500 people to 3,000 people in one group. They've been hiding in the jungle, trying to survive.
The Cambodian freedom fighter troops rescue Boon, nurse him back to strength, and then Boon joins them, making daring trips into the midst of the killing fields and rescuing thousands of people and bringing them back with him to safety with the Cambodian freedom fighters. Boon rises to the rank of general with the Cambodian freedom fighters and spends the rest of the time the Khmer Rouge are in power saving people. After the Khmer Rouge are deposed, Boon is eventually reunited with his entire family. Unbelievably, they all survived. Dita Nibagwiri was a 5-year-old girl living a normal life in Rwanda when her life was turned upside down. You see, Dita belonged to the group that was ethnically Tutsi, and they were a minority in Rwanda. The Hutus outnumbered them, and historically the two groups have had many issues. In April of 1994, those problems came to a head, and in 100 days, Hutu mobs killed over 800,000 Tutsis. Let's hear Dita's story.
As you've said, my name is Dita Tien Nibagwire. I've born and grew up in Rwanda. During the 94 Rwanda Tutsi genocide, I was only 6 years old. Before that, I was a normal kid in a very deep village in the southern province of my country. I was living with both my parents and 9 siblings, including me, who were 10. I didn't know what was going on. Maybe now when I grow up, that's where I started hearing story and I get to understand more. But I just saw everyone moving. We were all going, my parents and I and my siblings. And we went to the local offices, and there were so many people. I remember I used to ask my father why we were spending night outside, but he was always saying me that we'll later go back to our home. And yeah, we spent there days. I don't know, I can't count days. Like maybe it was like a week.
So in Dita's village, the first small wave of Hutu violence took a number of weeks to reach them. And even then, those who came to do the killing were unsure of themselves and thus were beaten back by Tutsi men at first. Then Dita tells of the next more sustained efforts, bolstered, believe it or not, by mass media, including radio calls for Hutus to kill any Tutsis they could find. I can't imagine turning on TV or the radio and seeing or hearing calls for people to kill those of a certain ethnicity or religion. But that happened in Rwanda. Let's listen to Dita talk about what happened next.
Because it was in the village, the killing started late. In other parts, like Kigali, started early on the 7th after the plane of the president crashed, the former president. And in the village, people didn't really know what to do. Like, the killers didn't have much information because they started killing late. But they were coming to the place where we were to try and kill. But all men and young men were trying to fight back. But, after that 2 weeks, that's when it really started. They got banned from the high-level leaders and got support from of other soldiers. They came shooting, and we were together. They didn't have gun and anything. I remember people started screaming, and they shooted my father. He was standing somewhere. I just saw him falling down, and then one of my sisters. And we started running with my mother, and it was hard for her. We were so many to take all, like, 6 kids running with them. They were all young. It took us to hide somewhere, and one of my sisters were wounded by grenades, which killed one of my other sisters. We went to hide in a nearest forest, I started asking my mom why they were killing us, and she told the only thing she told me, she was, we are Tutsi and we have to die. Starting from there, I knew that all Tutsi were supposed to die at that moment. We stayed in the forest, and then killers, after they finished everyone at the local offices, they come to search people who were in the forest and the bushes. That's where they found us, me and my mom and two of my sisters. The guy knew my mom, and he asked her, do you want me to kill your kids? And my mom said, it's your choice, you can do whatever you want. And he shooted my young sister, and it touches my other sister, the leg. But as my other sister was wounded, she had blood everywhere, and I was behind her. He thought we would both die, and she left my mom just to see her kids dying. And then after the other men come, they saw her, they were really arguing, saying, she was a nice person, we can't kill her. Others were like, we must kill her. And the others were like, let's take her clothes and leave her here. But they finally killed her, but she didn't die directly. I remember her voice asking my sister for water, but she couldn't find water. We were all hiding.
5-year-old Dita sees her mother and her father killed in front of her, sees several siblings murdered, including one who first has her leg cut off. After the deaths, Dita and her remaining siblings were desperate to find a place to hide and to ultimately find a safe haven.
Yeah, we started journey with my sister, my elder sister. We started hiding in neighbors. Some were saying, yes, they could hide us. And people, they knew, well, my father, like, we know he died, and his wife, well, the kids.
Hello.
Everyone was looking for us. And we had to take to walk to the province city. It was a long walk, and it was night, and we had to hide from roadblocks. And I was always tired. I was telling my sister that I couldn't move, so trying to carry me. Yeah, we ended up going to this vice mayor's house, because my sister knew her daughter. And he was like, he said, you know, I can't hide cockroaches. They used to call tutsi snakes or cockroaches. And her daughter took us somewhere to hide us somewhere, but they finally found us and took us to throw us in this big hole, toilet hole. And she knew that they thrown us in and paid the killers to come and remove us. And now that I'm, but I really can't believe how such a big killer who's in prison for life, how his daughter had two people. If she was not there, we could have died in that toilet, and she really saved us. She had to pay her money. As someone said, the first speaker, there were some, in those horrible things, there were always some good people.
Ultimately, Dita is able to find a place to hide for the remainder of the Rwandan genocide. I then asked Dita what the status of justice is for the perpetrators of the genocide.
19 years after the genocide began in Rwanda, what kind of justice has there been for you and other victims?
Yeah, I think it's always the same when it comes about genocide. We still have so many criminals, like, still living in France and having all their lives, living their lives as it was normal. Inside in the country, it was really hard to bring to justice, a million of case people accused for genocide. But really, the government used the traditional court, it's called Gachata, where people sit and try to resolve problem and punish those who are guilty. And it was successful, even if there's still more cases to resolve. But it was more successful than the International Court for Rwanda. There have been, it's been 19 years, but almost of the criminals still in the liberty. They're living us everywhere in the world, and they're still even denying the genocide. Yeah, it's hard to describe, but we are still hoping. We did our part as Rwandans and try to rebuild the destroyed country, but we are hoping for the best for the international cause.
6 of Dita's 10 siblings and both of her parents were lost to the genocide. The process for justice remains a difficult one in Rwanda. I spoke with the survivors after they discussed what happened to them, asking them about whether they were disappointed with the world's ability to prevent genocides. Saul, I wanted to ask you a question. I know that Holocaust survivors have the phrase, never again.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that working to that goal is one of the reasons that you give frequent talks on the Holocaust.
Absolutely.
I know this isn't the first time you're hearing about Rwanda and Cambodia, but it's really disappointing to hear that these things still went on after the Holocaust, isn't it?
Well, it is mostly because the killers are not being punished.
The killers are not being punished. Many Germans escaped into different parts of the world, and the people that should be looking to recapture these guys look the other way. I don't want to name names, but there are so many people that could have done something about it to hold on to these killers, and they didn't. They didn't free passage. So people learn from these weak spots, and those crimes keep on repeating because there's not enough punishment.
Dita and Boone, I want to hear from each of you. How do you feel knowing that the world should have really learned its lesson from Armenia and from the Holocaust? The world should have been able to prevent what happened in your countries. First, you, Boone. How do you feel about that when you hear these stories?
I think all the people all over the world have to come together, then try to war, then try to fight everybody, try to allow together.
How about you, Dita? What do you think?
I don't know. It's really hard to understand that, because I think the world should have prevented the genocide, at least in Rwanda, as the one I experienced. Everyone was watching, and people were telling, like Dalia saying, that something was happening in the country, but no one didn't care. I think it's a fail for the international community. Even now, after the Rwandan genocide, they keep on, they're never again. But there have been big massacres in Darfur and elsewhere. I don't know. Something have to be done. I don't know what. But they should have prevented the next genocide genocide happen after.
And you know what I think? People really need to hear that from you and from Saul and from Karine and from Boone. That's so important. So folks, I really want to thank you. I think we could go on talking with this amazing ensemble of people for hours, but unfortunately, that's all that we have for all the time that we have. So thank you to Karine and to Saul and to Boone and to Dita for being terrific guests and sharing what I know had to be some painful memories with us. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you for organizing.
You're welcome.
Thank you for organizing.
Thank you, Steve.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
When it comes to genocide, I'm reminded by a poem by John Donne that reads in part, "No man is an island entire of itself. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." I think that poem is appropriate for two reasons. I think it's true that any person's unjust death diminishes each of us. But also, there is no group safe from genocide. Here on our show, we've been talking about genocides where white people, black people, and Asian people were killed. Genocides in the last 100 years have been directed at Muslims in Bosnia, Jews in Europe, Christians in Armenia and Rwanda, and Buddhists in Cambodia. Everyone must take this horror seriously. That's one of the messages that I hope everyone takes away from this show. None of the folks or their families participating thought that something like this would happen to them until it was too late. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday,
April 13th, and Monday, April 14th,
at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter at Stephen Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.